It's demonstration day in beautiful Santa Cruz. The sun is out, and hopefully so will you be. Today at 2 o'clock at the town clock. Come join the campaign to end the sleeping ban, kick off the spring, and kick out that city council until it does some decent stuff for basic people's rights, rent control, basic rights for the homeless. And stay tuned for the April 29th edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM here in Santa Cruz. Call-in number is 427-3772, because not only are we Free Radio Santa Cruz, you don't pay for us, the commercial sponsors don't monopolize our time, the large corporations don't pay off the public broadcasting system to put their little messages in and vanillaize the content of what's going on in the programming situation. But you also have access to this station. You can call, you can speak, you can actually get on the air. 427-3772 is our on-air number, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, here at 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris, going to be with you for the next 2.5 hours or thereabouts. And then I'm running off to the town clock at 2 o'clock to be part of the, I guess it's going to be called, it hasn't got a specific name, but it's got a great flyer. High rent, tickets for sleeping. We need to legalize sleep for the homeless. We need to take to the streets in the largest possible numbers. It's our town. And this is the protest coming up today that's been advertised and publicized for the last month by numerous activists, among them former city council candidate and political prisoner Steve Argue, or Steadfast Steve, as I call him in the Street Shit Sheet, the homeless newsletter and occasional scandal sheet that I put out every week or two, or have, and I'm trying to get another one out soon. Hopefully that'll be coming out along with the new Street Spirit, which is coming down the pike. Probably the best homeless newspaper in the country for my money. That's usually at the beginning of every month, about a week into the month. You get the Street Spirit newspaper. Give a call to 423-HUFF if you're interested in either of these publications. 423-4833, 423-HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And that's a number you can also call when this show isn't on. And you can also call if you don't want to be on the air, but you've got some comments to make about something that's on the show, or you want to make some arrangements possibly about getting on the show, or having us discuss issues that you think are important, or pass on news to the community that you think is important. 423-4833, 423-HUFF. Also a contact point for Street Spirit, the Street Shit Sheet, and of course the San Francisco Coalition for the Homeless's Street Sheet, another monthly newspaper sold by homeless people as an alternative to panhandling. Not, I should say, as a way of making money in any meaningful way, but as a way of getting a little coffee money and getting a little something when the nights get cold or wet, and when you want to come indoors, if only to nurse a cup of coffee at Denny's at $1.35 a pop. So anyway, that's also what's happening this afternoon, as I said, at 2 o'clock at the town clock. We have Steve Argue and myself, Becky Johnson, who knows, perhaps some other surprise guests as well, talking about homeless issues that you've heard about before, no doubt ad nauseum on this radio show, but we really, of course, need to speak in a voice loud enough and unified enough and persistent enough that the community picks up this cry. And I notice I'm talking now about the community and not about the city council, which I often spend a lot of time talking about, I'm sure, in a way, far too much time talking about, because the community is what will make the difference here. The community will make the changes. And when the voices from the community become loud enough, when the tent city sits at City Hall long enough, when business downtown is, shall we say, alerted to the fact that we're encouraging a boycott if it continues to support sleeping bans and other laws that make it criminal for people who are poor to even exist in Santa Cruz, then the city council will scamper along after, and you'll see Candy Graham Chris Crone, and you'll see people like Emperor Tim Fitzmaurice, our mayor, suddenly deciding to change their policy, suddenly deciding that, my goodness, maybe there is a groundswell for changing things. But until we get out there and get this done, there's nothing going to happen. So it's really the community organizing that's important, and that's going to happen today at 2 o'clock. You're going to have a chance to speak out, bring a sign, bring a blanket, you know, bring a bathing suit. It's going to be nice warm weather. Bring yourself and come on down to the town clock at 2, downtown Santa Cruz, here in Santa Cruz. And until then, listen in, and maybe you might want to call in. 427-3772 is our phone number. And that, of course, our introductory song, in case you still remember it, was, of course, the ever-beloved We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, of course, much beloved by a few of us, and not so beloved by others, as well as the Free Radio Santa Cruz. I think it should be, in a way, the anthem of free radio stations throughout the country. It's a wonderful song by Carol Denny, Set Your Radio Free, and that's also available if you want to get information on how to get that tape. You can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll pass that on to you. So, welcome to Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides. I'm Bathrobe Spear, and my broadside is here. And I wish there was some light in this studio. It looks like there's just no light bulbs where they're supposed to be, so we're operating in the dark. And when you try to read 8-point print in the dark, it's a little difficult. But I'll tell you, I'm going to do it anyway. So here are a couple stories to start off with. Tucson, Arizona. Advocates for the homeless and poor are asking city officials to push back a May 1st date for enforcing a ban on street vendors. The city hasn't done enough job training or placement for vendors who don't have any other source of income, advocates say. Brian Flagg, manager of the Casa Maria Soup Kitchen, said replacement jobs have only been found for a meager number of the vendors who will lose their jobs once the ban is enforced. Vendors said the city is essentially tossing them into the streets. Maybe what the city wants to do is live in the desert and eat out of, it wants us to do is live in the desert and eat out of trash cans, said Bill Jackson, a newspaper vendor. Councilwoman Carol West, who pressed for the ban last year, said she would not support the proposed delay. The city council voted 6-1 in October to bar hawkers and other solicitors from medians. Officials promised to work with social service agencies to help provide job training or find vendors new work. City officials said the ban is needed to ensure the safety of both the vendors and the motorists. And, of course, I didn't follow this Tucson, Arizona debate, but when I heard a similar debate in Palo Alto, California, and I went up there 3 years ago with other homeless activists, and we found that they were claiming that they needed to have laws against sitting on the sidewalk because of trip and fall dangers. But the city risk manager, the city police chief, couldn't find any examples where there had actually been a person who'd tripped and fallen because of a person sitting on the street. But they pointed out it was an ever-present danger and that these vigilant city officials were going to make sure that that just didn't happen. Of course, we all know the real reason for this is to remove those unsightly homeless people from areas where upscale yuppies don't want them to be. And that's all very well if you want an upscale yuppie town. And that's, of course, I think, the real issue here. Are we going to allow a particular mindset and lifestyle to rule in Santa Cruz? And that essentially is a money lifestyle. And we see, of course, what this is doing to the rents. We see what this has done to the downtown in terms of schlock shops up and down the mall, coffee shops here, coffee shops there. Oh, it's so tourista. But what does it do to people who are just getting by or people who are trying to advance? It's a really sad situation and one that should make us angry because it is essentially the monopolization and expropriation of the public space by the rich as their own playground. And that, folks, sucks. And in order to fight that, that's another thing I'm going to encourage us to speak out against at the town clock today at 2 and organize against. Organize for an alternate vision of Santa Cruz. And we really are going to have to pound one out because you're not going to get it from these city council-sponsored groups. I don't think you're even going to get it from Mike Schmidt's well-intentioned effort to have a town hall meeting later this summer in July. He's with the involvement of the three members of the city council, Crone, Porter, and Riley, with the involvement of a number of, should we say, less than bold homeless advocates like Lydia Blanchard, Thomas Levitt, Charlie and Betsy Phillips, some folks who are, you know, well-intentioned, hearts are in the right place, but they're very low-key, they're very low-profile, and they're very much afraid of offending the city council. And they somehow think that by taking a very moderate approach, they're going to get somewhere. I think, on the contrary, what we need to do is take a strong, militant, clear approach that provides an alternate vision for people and engages in a healthy dialogue and discussion. Because I think this is true even for people who are initially predisposed to have a lot of bigotry toward homeless people, that they respect people who are honest about their positions. They respect people who come out clearly and say what they mean and don't schmaltz around and waltz around. And I'm not saying that the Monday morning group, which meets every Monday, by the way, if you want, at the 115 Coral Street. They'll be meeting tomorrow for the first time, actually, at the Homeless Services Center. They've been meeting elsewhere. You can go and check out the group. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, open to everybody but me. You can go down and have a peek. And I think actually it'd be good to go down and have a peek at the Homeless Services Center and talk to homeless people, because that's, I think, much more important than talking to folks who are mainly focusing their intentions on the city council and what they're doing, which seems to be the situation now. So today I hope we'll see a different kind of gathering at the town clock, a real strong protest that will lead to other kind of increasingly powerful protests that link struggles around rent control, around criminalization of the poor, around basic rights, and maybe political prisoners in jail, insofar as these are economic issues. I would even like to see the drug war linked here, because I think the drug war is the kind of militarization of the local scene. It produces great discretionary powers that can be abused and are abused regularly by police departments and private security forces, and also kind of come into vendettas even in private interactions between people. And it results in CPSs being called in, and it results in what I'm saying is this cry of drug abuse, which is a real problem. I'm not trying to say it isn't, but the notion that, and the reality that, more than 700,000 people, more than have ever been arrested before, were arrested for marijuana last year. Actually arrested, and I believe it's jailed for marijuana last year. It could have just been cited, but it's certainly the hugest number ever. It's not going away. This problem is not being resolved by a spreading medical marijuana movement, which is a good thing, but which is also to some extent a bad thing in my mind, because the medical marijuana group splits off from the other broader group that says decriminalize marijuana, which splits off from the broader group which says decriminalize drugs. The answer is to end prohibition for adults. I mean, that is the answer. It was the answer in 1932 and 33. It's the answer now. It's not the answer to the end of drug abuse. That's a much deeper question. But it is the answer to dumping all this money into this rat hole, and all of us know it. I'm sorry, all of us know it. What we need to do is get the guts to realize, get the mutual solidarity to realize that we have to act on that in a local way. We can't wait for our state legislators or for people to circulate initiatives or for Fred Keeley to come to his senses or for Christopher Crone to stand up and introduce a lowest priorities resolution as Berkeley did in 1979 around marijuana, and then the police just didn't pay any attention to it. We need to act ourselves to start ending this blight on our society, this blight on the family of human beings here in Santa Cruz and across the country. Even if we aren't the closest family members with everybody around, we know it's right to stop this. It has to happen. So anyway, all these issues hopefully will come together at the town clock today. I'm going to be babbling away as usual, so if you haven't had enough of me during this show, you can check me out at the clock. And to give you a break from me, I'm going to actually give you a bit of tape from, and I want to get this right, I don't think I actually, it was a forum that was held a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, by Jim Costner and others, mostly from over the hill, but some of them are local Santa Cruzans. I spoke. Beggar Backer Becky Johnson, local video journalist and activist, spoke. I guess Danny Garcia came in. He's the man who had a brother shot by the San Jose police. If I'm not mistaken, the Garcia. I think there's one guy up in San Francisco who had the same situation. I always confuse those two, but there's been a lot of, I think, really, at moments, we've really gotten together in an educational and inspirational way to remind ourselves of the kind of police brutality and police violence that we live in the middle of, and that we live, it's considered second nature, and just hasn't gone away and hasn't been corrected, and there have been no processes dealt with. Anyway, there was this forum that we had on Thursday some weeks ago. Jim Costner was there. He was the man who, as you know, smashed the Columbus statue in San Jose and is now back in jail awaiting a bail reduction hearing. His bail is $70,000 at the moment, and I believe the bail reduction hearing is in late May, or mid-May, actually. I'm going to give you the date later in the show if I can find it. And he actually had the courage to throw a forum at which the police could have arrested him for allegedly being a fugitive on this huge bail. They suddenly jumped the bail from $20,000 up to $70,000, and he held a forum at the Veterans Hall in the basement. We're going to now hear some selections from that forum. And then a week later, he surrendered himself. And his point being that he felt he was more valuable in the community organizing than outside. And I think that's true, although I take issue with the kinds of, you know, Jim often goes into these things himself passionately, and sometimes other people have to pay the financial consequences, or else he's stuck in jail, and that's always a problem. But it's also true that he did a great update, and you heard that on Thursday from jail about different people and what they were experiencing inside the San Jose jail. So it's a mixed bag, and I don't pretend to just rubber stamp what people do and sort of, you know, do unthinking solidarity with them. I'm critical of some of the things that happened, but I was glad that this forum took place. I was impressed with the turnout. There was 50 to 75 people there, and I guess there's going to be an organizing meeting stemming from that about a police brutality forum coming up in early May, which will happen after the rally at the town clock today, and you're invited to come to the rally, and I guess afterward there's going to be a meeting, which will be announced at the rally. Let's hear a little bit from this Thursday forum. I think you'll find it interesting.
Either. I just want you guys to know that. Thank you, Jim. We got really lucky tonight, and we got to have Jim's lawyer come and give us information about his case. And we weren't sure he was going to make it, but he's here, came all the way from San Francisco to be here tonight with us and tell us about what's going on. And we're really excited to have him. His name is Larry Hildes, and I want to bring him on up. Thank you, guys.
Usually it's easier to follow a client than tonight. To paraphrase Teddy Roosevelt, there's a man who speaks eloquently and carries a big sledgehammer. Thanks all for coming. I'm going to mostly talk about the legal situation. I promise I will probably drift into politics a few times. This is too political a case not to. When Jim took that sledgehammer to the Statue of Columbus, he shook the power structure in San Jose. He shook a place that is substantial majority people of color, is a substantial majority descended of people who are descended from American Indians, where all the money is white and all the power is white, and Silicon Valley is about as white and as rich as it gets now, or was until the stock market started to drop. And he said to that power structure, your time is not forever. You're not going to be doing this forever. You're not going to have your symbols of oppression in the buildings of the people forever. And that's why they've reacted like this. They have been treating Jim like he murdered Columbus with a sledgehammer. They have been treating this like the crime of the century. Bail was $4,000. The Italian-American groups in San Jose who had donated the statue, who have a lot of the real power and money in San Jose, as I said, the money base is white, it's Italian and Irish mostly, they called the DA, and the DA jumped, and they came up with an excuse, and they called Judge Stafford, and Judge Stafford jumped and came up with an excuse, and they raised the bail to $50,000. $50,000 is bail for attempted murderers, for rapists, for real criminals, for serious, dangerous felons. Jim is not a serious felon. He is dangerous, but he's not dangerous physically. He is not dangerous in any criminal sense. He is not dangerous in any sense that they can justify holding him in prison. And we went in front of a more reasonable judge. We got the bail lowered to $20,000, which was still outrageous, but we got him out. And they were up there claiming the statue was worth $150,000. The statue was worth $300,000. They're charging him with a hate crime. Columbus is not a protected class. Thank you. Columbus is not an oppressed people. Nobody ever oppressed Columbus. Would be a good place to start. He came from Spain, the Inquisition, and he brought the Inquisition here. Nobody ever oppressed this man. He did all the oppressing. Howard Zinn in People's History of the U.S. talks about the fact that Columbus wrote back to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, the people here are generous, they are kind, they have been good to us, they will make excellent slaves. That's Columbus. And that's the court system here. So we got the bail lowered, we got Jim out of jail, they came back in, we were supposed to have a scheduling conference to set new dates. And they suddenly changed the pleadings and said, Your Honor, we need more bail because the damage to the statue is over $50,000. They were always saying it was over $50,000. They got a judge to raise the bail to $70,000 for an act against a statue. And they're still claiming the statue is worth $300,000.
$300,000?
$300,000 they're up to. We got the article from the San Jose Mercury News from 1958. October 20th, 1958, the statue was erected. The groups that donated the statue, which, by the way, took a tax write-off for it, they claimed that the statue might be worth as much as $3,500. Even if this has gone up 10 times, and let's face it, this is not Michelangelo's David. This is not a great work of art. It's not even a very good work of art. Even if it had gone up 10 times in value in that 40 years, that's $35,000. That's not $50,000, that's not $150,000, that's sure as hell not $300,000. They lie. The powerful and the rich say, we cannot allow this to happen. You must find a way to put this man in prison. And they lie. And if the value of that statue is only $3,500, that's a misdemeanor. Even if it's totally destroyed, that is not a felony. So they are lying. The charges they have now brought with the value over $50,000, and they're claiming that if we get him out, they'll say that the value is over $100,000. They'll try to raise the bail again. They're going to keep playing these games. And it was illegal when they did it. And they lied to do it. We keep demanding to know how much the statue's worth, what they base that on. They won't tell us. Now we know why. They won't tell us because they lied. And believe me, we're going to go back in with this. And we've already told the press, and we're already telling all of you that they lied about the value of the statue. We're going to go back into court and tell them. The charges that they have Jim on, including the hate crime. Now, nobody's discriminated against anybody involved with this, even if you buy the argument that Columbus was Italian, which nobody has ever proved. Nobody has oppressed Italians anywhere since Mussolini, and he was one of them.
I'm Italian, and I've been oppressed all my fucking life.
That's right. Yeah, brother.
But if you've been oppressed because you're Italian.
You gotta stop the barbaric bullshit now.
Okay. In any case, Italians are not a protected class. Italians faced oppression when they first got here. They were white. One generation later, they were doing it to people who couldn't. To the people of color in this country. They are not part of the solution. They are not the victims here. So there is no hate crime. The hate crime enhancement is worth 2 years. If you total the amount they're claiming the statue is worth as a felony, and the fact that if Jim entered the building with the intent of committing a felony, that's burglary. Of course, if the statue is worth $3,500, no felony, no burglary. They're wanting 8 years in prison. By lying about what happened, by lying about it being felonies, by lying about the value of the statue, by claiming he intended violence, they have made a crime out of a simple act. That's not a felony, but even by their standards, it's a misdemeanor. And let's talk about that. They want to replace the statue. The mayor wants to replace the statue. They're talking about the replacement value of the statue. First of all, it's not worth what they say it is. And second of all, why should it be replaced?
Really?
Why do we need a statue? Why should we have a statue of a mass murderer? And Jim has talked about Columbus. I didn't hear all of it, but I know Jim, and I know Jim talked about Columbus. I know there are a lot of folks here who will talk about what Columbus did. Why do we have a statue of a man who invaded another country and said, look what I discovered, there's nobody here, and proceeded to wipe out the population and enslave the population and set the tone for the next 500 years of genocide? We want a statue of this man. We have to replace the statue of this man. Hell, if we want a statue of anybody in San Jose, let's have a statue of Cesar Chavez. That's where the money in San Jose came from. That's why San Jose has money. San Jose has money because Latino farm workers, when this was still orchards, made San Jose money. And that's how we're going to fight this case. We're not going to argue that Jim didn't do it. We're going to argue the statue wasn't worth that much and it shouldn't be replaced. We're not going to argue that it was a mistake. We are going to argue that he had a right to do it. We are going to put Columbus on trial. We are going to show what Columbus looks like. Actually, I've been speaking with the group that's been doing a lot about that. But yes, that should be an issue. Why do we have a holiday for a man who practiced genocide and slavery?
There's a petition on the table that you're opposed to the holiday. Please sign it.
So that's what we're going to do when this comes to trial. We need help from you all. We need resources. We need people. They got away with raising Jim's bail. Jim had to flee because we didn't have people in court to fight it. Believe me, when that courtroom was full, they trembled. The judge trembled, the DA trembled, the bailiffs were all scared to death, and we got some justice out of it. So we need you all in court. Jim has details. Apparently there's going to be a march organized for the near future. There's going to be a lot of stuff happening. We need you all in court. We need whatever donations you can, because we've got to get expert witnesses who can talk about Columbus, who these people will listen to. We have to keep the courts in line. We have to keep the judges in line. We have to damn well get this DA to tell the truth. So that's where we are on this case. We'll keep you posted when we have new dates. We don't have any dates set right now. Once Jim is back in their system, if Jim is back in their system, we will immediately move to reduce the bail. They violated the law. They were supposed to give us 5 days notice, and they were supposed to have, they cannot raise the bail after he's paid it unless he's done something new. They have new information that they just discovered. All they discovered is they wanted to change the amount that they claimed he vandalized it with no new information. That is a lie. And they got away with it because the courts are corrupt and falling in line. And we need you all to put them back where they're supposed to be. We can have the people's justice, but we need the people to make them give it to us. They won't give it to us on their own. We have to take it from them. So thank you all for coming. We'll keep you posted as things go. Please come to court with us. Please march in the streets with us. And please make sure that they don't put that statue back in. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Larry. Just wanted to read a couple parts from the petition to get rid of Columbus Day as a national holiday. The UnitedNativeAmerica.com, they're a group out of Oklahoma. That's their website, UnitedNativeAmerica.com. They have a beautiful website with incredible graphics, beautiful music, and they have this fantastic petition to get rid of Columbus Day. It is a federal holiday. People get paid to take a day off to celebrate this man. That's pretty scary. And these are some of the quotes from it. We, the undersigned, come together before you to request that each of these governing bodies take all necessary action to bring about a federal holiday for Native American elected leaders, to include congressional hearings on the racial exclusion of Native Americans in the movies, television, sports, advertising, music companies, etc. And by the way, this is written to all the people of the world, with the Congress of the United States, Senate of the United States, and President of the United States underneath. This is who we're trying to get their attention from. The holiday would pay tribute to Indian tribal leaders, to include Alaskan Nation leaders, Hawaiian Nation leaders, Taino Nation leaders of Puerto Rico, all U.S. territorial tribal nation leaders indigenous to the land. The holiday should also pay tribute to all those that endured the world's longest Holocaust and most costly in human lives. Therefore, let it be resolved that the federal government should reevaluate Columbus Day by moving it back to its original day, the second Wednesday of October, and not be a tax-paid holiday, as is St. Patrick's Day, Oktoberfest, and make the second Monday of October a federal holiday for Native Americans. There's a few more things at the bottom. There's also the website. We have these on the back with a place to put your name, your signature, and your address when you're leaving or when you're up walking around. Please sign it. Also with the UEPLO, as you're coming in, we're trying to get people's numbers, their emails. We want to get in touch with you. We want to create momentum with you. We want to get that energy going that I know we're getting here tonight, so that we can make change, so that Columbus does not go up, so that Fallon does not go up, that we have this power. It's our power. And if we don't unleash it, it just stays stagnant, and we don't make the change, and we sit there and we suffer, and we don't need to suffer. That's why we're here. So I really hope and encourage that you guys all sign this. It's really, really important. And I'm going to bring up a Native elder from Sacramento. He came all the way down here, and we are just so blessed to have him here to speak with us, to share his opinions, his views. And with all respect, we're going to bring up Yellow Hawk White Vic. Please come on up.
Somebody turns that thing off and on. I saw him coming. If we could turn it off now, please.
Yes.
I'm an ROG, just like a regular old guy. I'm not no kind of elder. In our tradition, I'm not even an adult for another 7 years or so. And I heard about what was going on, and I saw some things on the internet, and I thought, okay, this young person here that's got a whole lot of passion, a whole lot of energy. When we heard about the hate crimes enhancement, so he must have pissed somebody off, didn't it? But that's one of the problems with new laws. They're going to come after the same people that they're coming after with the old laws. And we have a responsibility to pay attention to what the hell they're doing. And not just jump on a particular bandwagon because it looks like somebody got hurt real bad and nothing happened. Sometimes people just say, well, that's part of the problem with what people derisively call liberals. And I don't particularly like those tags of any kind, because each and all of us are human beings. And we're related to the plant beings. And we're related to the animal beings. And the violence that was done to the earth was done when they took the material out of her to build that damn statue. We need to pay attention to who we are and to our responsibilities, because that's where the attacks are. They're trying to mine away our being. Now I think they believe that they can make something that's like a replica of a human, but they can't make a human being. We were put here the same time and same kind of manner. I don't know about the time, I wasn't there. But in the same kind of manner as the rest of our relatives, the rest of the beings. Now I'm going to take a few moments and talk to the spirits of this land, and we're going to do some things. I don't know if y'all already have done it, and kind of if you have, it won't hurt any.
And actually, I believe that you are, of course, listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And that was the Thursday, I think it's April 12th, that was when it happened, the Veterans Hall basement kind of forum on political prisoners that Jim Costner and others threw. And you heard there's some interesting stuff. We're going to be hearing a little bit more of that later in the show. This, of course, is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm your host, Bathrobes Peer Robert Norris. Here's an interesting story from, looks like Washington. Dying man's shouts went unheeded, struggling for breath, D.C. defendant taken to cell block, not hospital. By Neely Tucker, Washington Post, Friday, April 27th. In the last moments of his life, Robert Waters collapsed in front of the defense table in courtroom 115 of D.C. Superior Court last Friday and pleaded for help. "Get me to D.C. General," the 54-year-old defendant shouted over and over, according to three witnesses. "I need air." Senior Judge Tim Murphy peered over the bench, called for nurses, and then kept the busy afternoon docket of traffic and misdemeanor cases rolling. As Waters lay prone in the well of the court, struggling for breath with a nurse at his side, defense attorneys and prosecutors haggled over plea bargains and fines. Defendants came and went. The court clerk filed papers, and the rapid pace of the courtroom never slowed. "We had something like 150 cases that afternoon, and if you stop the court, it can get chaotic," Murphy said yesterday. He was being attended to. There wasn't anything we could have done. "He looked like a street person. The marshals told me the nursing staff had checked him out twice. He didn't seem in that bad shape to me. He kept yelling for air. I finally leaned over and told him, 'Well, if you'd quit yelling, maybe you could get some air.'" Courtroom observers noted that defendants in hectic urban courtrooms often try to act out medical complaints or otherwise disturb proceedings. So after 10 minutes, U.S. Marshals pulled Waters to his feet and returned him to the cell block. Then he died. "The marshals thought it was a big joke," said another defendant in the cell block, who requested anonymity because he feared retribution. "He kept asking for help, saying, 'I can't breathe, man,' and the marshals would say, 'Right, buddy.' He finally collapsed on the floor. When they went in there, he wasn't breathing." D.C. Fire Department logs show operators first received a call at 3:01 p.m., at least 90 minutes after Waters first asked for help. He was in cardiac arrest, department records show, when paramedics arrived. He was pronounced dead at Howard University Hospital. A week later, Waters' death seems to have passed through the city's busiest courthouse with barely a ripple. Other than Murphy, few court officers would talk about it, and few seemed to know about the death of a defendant who apparently suffered a heart attack while in court custody on a minor charge, drinking alcohol in public. "I have no comment about that whatsoever," said Todd W. Dillard, U.S. Marshal. Waters' court-appointed attorney, Robert Athanas, would not comment. The court's nursing staff also declined to comment. Other lawyers in the courtroom who could be found declined to comment or spoke on condition that they would not be named. Jonathan L. Arden, the D.C. medical examiner, said last night that his office was awaiting lab results to determine the exact cause of death. In the courthouse, all inquiries were referred to Margaret Summers, the court's public affairs officer, who did not know of Waters' death until informed by a reporter Wednesday. Yesterday, Summers issued a two-paragraph statement saying that the court was, quote, saddened by the unfortunate death of Waters, but noting that the court's medical staff had administered to him four times that day, including providing cardiopulmonary resuscitation after his final collapse. In the hours before he died, quote, two different nurses, after checking his lungs and vital signs, found him fit for further proceedings and transferred to D.C. jail, she wrote. Waters was apparently homeless, according to his court papers, which list him as having no fixed address for at least 4 years. One court file, however, lists an address in the 1700 block of Lincoln Road Northeast. Court records show that Waters was arrested 27 times in the past 15 years, usually on charges of petty assault, possession of marijuana, boarding a bus without fare, or disorderly conduct. He had been convicted of 4 misdemeanors. No family members were listed in any court documents. In his final run-in with the law, Waters was wanted on a bench warrant charge when he was arrested for allegedly drinking alcohol in public in the 2800 block of Bladensburg Road, Northeast, on April 19th. The next day, he was listed as D.C. Lockup Number 2 in court files. He complained of breathing problems twice to U.S. Marshals while in custody and was seen by nurses each time. Pronounced healthy, he was brought into the courtroom with many other defendants between 1 and 1:30, according to Murphy. He immediately walked into an open area in front of the judge's bench and collapsed, witnesses said. There was a loud thump, and everyone looked up, and there was this guy laying flat out in the well of the court, yelling that he couldn't breathe, said one lawyer, who spoke on condition of anonymity. The general mood in the room was that he was faking. The nurses came in to look at him. The lawyers, the judge kept calling cases. Court kept going on around him. One might say the murder machine continues, even as it kills the people in front of it by inaction. It's incredible and, of course, very telling that even the public defenders in this situation won't be quoted, no doubt for fear of liability, because they weren't taking the action that any other human being in any other situation would take, except that this is the death machine we're talking about, the U.S. court system. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobe's Pierre Robert Norse. This is a twice-weekly show that concerns itself with civil rights for homeless people in Santa Cruz and elsewhere. And we invite you to call in at 427-3772. Ever had a problem like this while you were in custody, or seen anything like this happen in court? Or have you heard anything that would be of use or interest to us locally in bringing home these issues? Give us a call at 427-3772. 427-3772. So we've got some interesting stuff coming up today, and I'm hoping we can get on the line with us later, Richard Quigley. Richard is an activist who has done a number of things, particularly stuff around courts. He's a man who knows courts, as I've said in past shows, probably better than most judges in this county. A helmet if you're a motorcyclist, even though in numerous cases helmets make it more risky rather than less risky, and it of course depends on the nature of the accident you suffer. We're going to be calling him around another case, which I'm going to read you a bit about, and that is a case I hope I brought with me. Boy, won't that be a bummer if I don't have that along. It's a Supreme Court decision, which we recently saw, a horrible decision that came down a couple of days ago, the Atkinson decision. I think actually I may unfortunately not have it with me. What a bummer. This is a decision out of a Texas court which allowed the police to arrest, handcuff, and abuse a mom and two kids for not having a seatbelt fastened. Now it's a minor infraction, although in Texas it was actually a misdemeanor, and so technically the officer was within his rights. But the kinds of comments the Supreme Court made were that, by a 5-4 majority, they seemed to say that the police departments and legislatures of each state could set their own process, independent of the Constitution, on minor infractions, that they don't have to, they can permit the police to engage in full searches, custodial arrests on things that should require simply signing a citation, but that the police have discretionary powers. And this, of course, is very significant and is something that we're going to be seeing, I think, unfortunately, the ramifications of locally with our own police force, who sometimes act stupidly and sometimes act more stupidly around issues of homeless people, issues of counterculture people downtown, bicyclists. We've talked about a lot of these things on the air. How we have a set, of course, of stupid laws given to us by Councilmember Kennedy and Councilmember Rotkin, and maintained in power by Councilmembers Crone, Fitzmaurice, Sugar, Porter, and Riley. They're the great progressive majority, and by their scanbackers who had their meeting last week, but have absolutely nothing to say about the sleeping ban that they, in terms of getting rid of it, in spite of their past dedication to that. Apparently this time they couldn't give a shit. At least I haven't heard that they did, and if I'm wrong about that, perhaps all you scansters out there can call in and tell me what wonderful strides SCAN is making, other than altering its bylaws to ratify the sort of elitist closed-door process of its steering committee, which moved last October to essentially destroy the Housing Committee, which is one of the few groups working around ending the sleeping ban and protecting the rights of Latino tenants in the beach flats. So we have a situation where it's a danger that police will overreact and exercise abusive power in minor cases. And we've seen it happen before. A month ago, a youth was allegedly punched out by Officer Gunther down at the farmer's market. At least that's what several individuals claimed, although I think Gunther, who I didn't speak to directly but heard secondhand, denied it. We've had cases of people getting tickets for chalking on the sidewalk downtown recently. There haven't been a lot of sleeping ban tickets, but there has been some sleeping ban harassment going on. And of course, we have the armory closed, and we have a situation where there's space for less than 52 people currently will have access to church floors every night, and in 3 days that'll shrink to 20, it's either 26 or 28 spaces that people will have on the floor of churches. There may actually be a few more because they've opened one extra church. That's out of about 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, so it obviously is completely inadequate. And instead you have people who are facing $54 tickets, and more important, they're facing unsafe sleeping situations where if they try to sleep together for protection, they face the possibility and the likelihood of police harassment, harassment from bigots who have the law on their side, thanks to Emperor or Mayor, if you will, Tim Fitzmaurice, and his pals in the Green Party, who are doing absolutely nothing about this other than pursuing those of us who are trying to change the situation and criticizing us because we criticize the Green Party for doing nothing. It's a sad situation. A couple of details about upcoming meetings on the sleeping ban. Unfortunately, the two main groups meeting are doing, to my mind, very little. The main group that's meeting, of course, today is the people, and they are meeting in a protest at the town clock at 2 o'clock. And I invite everyone to come on down to that protest where I and others will be speaking about, some call it a Rent Rage 2 rally, which is a rally, rage against rent, which is great, although the first such rally, which is in the beach flats, seemed to me to be a sort of a city council, buddies of the city council production, the 204 Riverside tenants who are being screwed by the landlords, but who are also being used as the poster child, the scare tactic to get the Dolphin Lee project passed, even though there's no guarantees for the people that they're throwing out that they'll keep their housing. Instead of real rent control discussion and real action, we are getting chatter from city council members and refusal to address the issue. And we're getting these photo opportunities and these PR puff piece things that are going on at city council, as every week you get Tony Madrigal dragging the 204 Riverside people in front of the city council. And I'm not saying it is good that they come up there, but instead of demanding that there be some real action, they just keep repeating the same horrible sob stories, which are real. You know, people are suffering, but you're not getting the city council doing anything significant or meaningful on the issue other than these sort of stopgap measures. And I saw a reply from Scott Kennedy, a council member who did a lot to create this situation by his schmoozing with the Seaside Company and his sort of, his concern about brokering business interests that became paramount after 1994, I think, for Kennedy, or even before that. For the last 8 years when he was council member, now he's been reelected. So there's a problem with him there. And but, you know, we had hoped we had a new broom sweeping out the Kennedy, Rotkin, Matthews, Hernandez gang. And no, you know, it's the same mentality. It's now Fitzmaurice who's lending his name to this, and Crone and Sugar, who are going along, and Porter and Riley, who are going along as well. They're all sort of just rolling merrily along. And we can hear from Emily Riley as you munch her pastries and sip her coffee at Emily's bakery that, you know, good people are trying to do good things. You know that. So be content about that while people get harassed for sleeping. I'm not content. I hope you're not content. Hope you come to the rally today at 2, and I hope you also call in and let me know your thoughts on any of this. 427-3772 is the call-in number here at Free Radio. 427-3772. And I'm looking for a... I guess now I'm going to try to take an opportunity to get through to some folks on the phone. While I do that, here's this. And now a little bit more of the Costner Forum. Yours truly is speaking about Costner. We kind of joined this in mid-sentence, but I think you'll pick up the drift. This is more of a kind of a personal background of Jim Costner and the activism he's done in this community. I've heard it said, and I think truly, that Jim tends to go off in his own direction, and sometimes there's some people who feel that the leadership fantasy, the leadership kind of charismatic notion of follow the leader, doesn't play well among a lot of activists in this community, and Jim gets a rough reception at times because he is kind of the preacher's son kind of fella, and that's true about him, and it's to some extent a matter of style, and it's, you know, it can have, it's, there have been factional disputes that have arisen in this community because of around Jim and other people. Oh, you know, some people have said the same thing about me, and perhaps not with some validity. You know, I'm often in meetings that I throw, often I do a lot of dominating, try to get agendas moved forward, though in meetings with other people I'm pretty I'm more circumspect because I'm often called on that. So, but anyway, here's me talking about Costner, and there are a couple of other speakers again talking about issues I think you'll find interesting.
Yeah, probably most of you know me from either my radio show, which happens twice a week, and actually that's the reason I'm late, because the show is usually from 6 to 8 every Thursdays, and from 11 to 1:30 in the Sunday afternoons. Free radio gives a lot of good information on these subjects, and I only hope that we can get Jim better access to free radio, as has been the case in the past. There are always factional problems in Santa Cruz, and sometimes people are fighting each other when they should be turning their attention to bigger things.
Yeah.
It's a real problem. Right now I'm working on, of course, an old issue that everybody's heard about probably in this room, the sleeping ban, the city's 11 to 8:30 a.m. go to sleep, go to jail law if you're outside or in a car, $54 fine. And Becky has talked to you a little bit about the Coffee Klatch 3 and what happens when actually it was 17 of us, go to the mayor's office, not even to sit in, not in a mass protest, but just sort of one by one trying to get some time with a city council member. And eventually they decide they want to get rid of you, and they use whatever means they can, and they're using against us a restraining order. And as you've heard, we have successfully called the mayor on the carpet, so on May 29th, he will be called upon to testify in court. We have to pay him $150 to do this, as you probably also heard, but that's the witness fee. But still, hopefully, there won't be money completely down the tube. You're spending $10,000 of your money, at least, for this lawsuit, because that's how much the city is paying to essentially defend the mayor's practice of excluding the public from the offices. And the reason this is important for us is not just because I'm sure everybody here probably feels it's ridiculous, if not criminal, to arrest homeless people for sleeping when they have no shelter, but it's also an attack on all activists. If some people went to the city council or city hall, I can't go to the city hall and give a message on Jim's behalf because I'm barred from there by restraining order. I won't be able to do that till May 29th unless it's a regular meeting or it's some other office. I can't do that. I want to talk a little bit about Jim's history, though, because I don't know that anybody has talked about it. Has anybody discussed Jim's history in Santa Cruz here? I don't know, because I wasn't here earlier. Well, I'm still going to talk about Jim's history, even if he's leaving, because I think that it's worth talking about. But I first kind of came to know Jim in 1994, when there was a series of protests, again, around the issue of homeless civil rights. There was a series of protests around the sleeping ban, and then the city reacted by criminalizing protests against the sleeping ban and putting in the infamous sitting ban. It's now illegal if you're in Santa Cruz to sit 10 feet from a storefront, 50 feet from an ATM. It's illegal to ask for a dime after dark. First time you do it, it's a $162 fine. The second time you do it, it's up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. And this isn't uniformly enforced. Not everybody will be hauled in. But it operates as a kind of pall of fear over people. And the police can selectively use it to do this to anybody they want to. Well, Jim and I and others were involved in a coalition in the spring of 1994 to fight these anti-homeless laws. And as part of this, we started a boycott of 7 stores because they were stores that initiated the anti-homeless laws. Atlantis Fantasy World, Bookshop Santa Cruz, the ID Building, the now defunct Cat and Canary, a series of other stores. And actually, I have nothing against the owners of these stores. I like these people. I know some of them personally. But they've made wrong choices about homeless people. But Jim, as I said, began, sort of, he proposed these stores. I supported him. And I haven't been back to those stores to buy anything in 8 years, since 7 years. And I don't know if he has either. We're probably the two only people I know who are still barred from the Bookshop Santa Cruz, because somebody threw a rock through the window of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, because the owner of the Bookshop Santa Cruz was once a mayor who supported these anti-homeless laws. Now, I don't support people throwing rocks through windows of bookstores, even bookstores of people who I think are making the wrong political choices. But still, Jim and I were barred for that. Later in 1996, well, actually in 1994, Jim was arrested with me for protests against the sleeping ban and what we called insomnia night, where we slept outside Stephen King's book reading of Insomnia. It's kind of had a little good humor to the idea that, you know, why should homeless people have to walk around all night? Because that's what this crazy sleeping ban law makes people do every night if they are to follow the law. Of course, people don't. But it's still, that's the letter of the law. Still, tonight, even as we speak after 11 o'clock at night. And the IWW came to town in 1994, and the entire IWW conference slept in the streets in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, and the police, in their progressive, benign demeanor, all turned away and did nothing. The next night, when Jim and I and a handful of other people slept, they arrested us. So you can see that the hardcore folks tend to get the short end of the stick. In 1996, Jim lived a block away from the city council, right across from the old police station. And at that time, there was a 7.5-month protest against the sleeping ban going on every night at City Hall. He supported this regularly with a group called the Revolutionary Coalition. He would hold marches. Well, the rest would say another march. He'd say yes. He'd go out there and he'd do another march. And he was there for those folks in 1996. He was one of 7 people arrested for locking themselves to the fixtures of City Council. He wasn't quite able to do it. The other 6 locked down. He was sort of about to lock down when they dragged everybody off. A jury refused to convict him of this, not because he didn't do it, but because they said, this is wrong what the city council is doing, and this was a protest that was simply trying to show that. This is what we call jury nullification. And hopefully, if Jim goes before a jury with his case, there will be another case of jury nullification.
Yeah.
Jim has been dragged to the sidewalk and brutalized for questioning a police officer who was removing a Mumia poster, if I remember correctly, on Pacific Avenue. We actually have this on videotape. We'll have to have, you know, best moments, the Costner highlights at some point. Jim turned himself in the spring of 2000 after a Kosovo protest the year before where police badly overreacted, sentenced one man, Steve Argue, to jail for 7 months, actually for 9 months. He served 7 because he defended a woman and child in a brutal assault by police officer David Lefebvre, who has since left the police force. He has also was found guilty of excessive force in a recent finding by the independent investigator. However, the police chief has refused to give his final findings on this matter. I'm still trying to pry it out of that department on the board. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But at least there has been some confirmation, even though a man had to spend 7 months in jail. And another man, Jim, spent a number of months in semi-fugitive status and eventually turned himself in a press conference at the police station last spring. This was a press conference that I found myself skeptical. I argued with him about it. I said, you're lone wolfing again, Jim. But 50 or 60 people showed up. Lots of media showed up. Jim showed me that He has some significant support for the kinds of passionate, and it's not just gestures, I would call them actions, that he does. He has a preacher's style and a preacher's cadence. When he, in that springtime, he went into jail a year ago, he did a fast, and he reported from jail on what was happening with prisoners in jail. And I'm hoping that if he's unfortunate enough to be locked up, we can do something similar, though I think they no longer allow three-way calls, so it's harder to do from jail to get those reports out. I frankly wasn't happy when I heard that Jim had smashed the Columbus statue, not because of I have any love for Columbus. No, I love Columbus. He's my hero. Right, it was a statue, not because I have any regard for Columbus, because I have regard for Jim. I didn't want to see him locked away for this kind of an action. I immediately thought, I also was caviling, why didn't he have witnesses? Why didn't he, bring a camcorder? How about a press conference? I was thinking all these things. Here's just a man who walks in alone with a sledgehammer and eliminates the statue. And I worried that he was setting himself up for jail again. And I thought, well, some would say this is egotism or desperation or some kind of lone wolf move. And there is an element of that, of course, in all of this and all of what we do. But I also, on reflection, see a kind of truth in what is going on here and a kind of passion and dedication. And above all, it's an unquenchable determination to speak out on an issue. I continue to question whether the price is worth the voice, but the passion is undeniable, and the truth of the situation is also undeniable. Now, I haven't been keeping time. How much time have I used up here? About 2 minutes left? Okay. So I've got all kinds of little notes here about what I might talk about. But a lot of what I would talk to you about, you can read about. You can probably read about it more quickly by just grabbing a flyer from the table. There's two newspapers that I write in, kind of civil rights updates, Street Sheet and Street Spirit. I publish my own Santa Cruz newspaper or newsletter called the Street Shit Sheet, for which I'm probably going to be read out of the Green Party on Saturday between 4 and 6, if anyone wants to come and watch me get crucified. It's silly, these kinds of factional disputes that go on. It's not something that... We have to keep our eye on the real issues. And the real issues, of course, have to do with basic human rights, I think. At least those are my real issues, primarily.
Human rights.
We need them. That's what I'm saying. We need those human rights.
How are the media taking over
the Well.
There's life on Mars.
If you want, that's okay. If you want to read my take on it, though, I encourage people to take a look at the Street Shit Sheet, which is what I put out. And it's very humble. You'll find it on the table. I give a quarter to a homeless person when you pass such a person on the street. Because that's what the price of this is. Don't give it to me, just give it to them the next time you see a person out there. If you have a story, if you have a cause of your own, something you see particularly that concerns low-income or poor people, the phone number to call for me is easy to remember. It's 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. That's an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, HUFF. So that's pretty much all I've got to say here, although I could go on forever. I'll have some literature over there, kind of at the far end of the table, if you want to check out what civil rights activities I've been doing around homeless causes. And I appreciate everybody's coming here tonight. I was afraid there'd be three people in the audience, and I'm really glad to see that I'm wrong again. So, thank you. And that was... Again, forum at the Veterans Hall, April 12th, and you were hearing me and others talking at the Political Prisoners Forum, which was also concerning itself to a large extent with Jim Costner's attack on the Columbus statue. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop's peer, Robert Norris, and on the line with me now, I have that man about the courts, Richard Quigley. Hey, Richard.
How you doing?
I'm good. You and I have been kind of huddling by phone the last couple of days around a number of things, but one thing that's occupied your attention has been the Atwater decision, and unfortunately, though you did email me the complete text of that decision, I wasn't able to get it all printed up before the show. Do you want to summarize for the audience what that Supreme Court decision was?
Yeah. It was Rehnquist and Company have decided that if a state wants to enact a law requires you to protect yourself, such as a seatbelt law. In this case, particular case, it was a seatbelt law. That carries with it an arrest for violation. That they can, by God, do that. It's quite okay with the Supreme Court. They've given the okay to that kind of behavior.
So it means that on a relatively trivial offense, and I think that you probably have some of the facts of this law in front of you. Maybe you can read them or can kind of articulate them for the audience. On a relatively minor matter, and the police officer is given search and arrest powers just for such a trivial thing as a seatbelt failure to be actually belted, right?
Yeah, what they wrote in the opinion was is that if the state feels that it's important enough to make it an arrestable offense, that such a statute would not violate the unreasonable searches and seizures provisions of the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. It's just ridiculous.
And this, of course, came out of a Texas court, right?
No. This is the United States Supreme Court.
No, but I mean the original case came out.
Oh, the original case was a Texas case. Yeah, this woman was arrested for a seatbelt violation by a cop who had a history of unacceptable behavior, and she sued him personally because she thought that she believed, and with good cause, that such an arrest would constitute a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. She was fortunate in that she had a friend with her that picked up her kids, but she was, in fact, cuffed up and hauled off to jail, and her truck was towed from the scene.
Do you have, like, the description of that event? I was reading it. It was rather vivid, the Supreme Court description that it was part of the pleadings, I guess. I wonder if you have that accessible, and can you read that?
Well, I mean, which part are you talking about?
Just a description of the facts of the case, first of all.
No.
Nope. Okay.
Well, I'm not that good a reader, first of all, and I can't really focus on what it was. It wasn't like I had time to prepare it, but it's anybody can find it. It's up on Find Law, and Atwater is Atwaters.
That's the case.
Yeah.
If anybody wants more information on it, I actually have it thanks to you, Richard, in a form that I can email it to people. I'd be happy to pass it on. And the number to call if you want that decision is 423-4833, and then just leave your email address, and I'll email it to you. It just seemed to me that here was this kind of archetypally middle-class woman with two kids in her car going to soccer practice or something, and she was stopped by this cop who apparently there was some suspicion, some facts to indicate that he had something. He was previously harassing her. He had some previous experience with her that was negative. And
I don't think it was necessarily with her. I think just generally he had an attitude not dissimilar from some of the people that you've met from time to time in city of Santa Cruz.
You know, I'd like to get the specifics of that in a future discussion we have, and I'll try to bring that into the studio on Thursday when we come back between 6 and 8 in the evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. But now, when we initially saw this case, it was kind of shocking. This is a decision by Souter, right?
Yeah, it was written by Souter, and it was signed on to by the other fascists on the bench, not the least of which is our illustrious Supreme Court Chief Justice.
The Honorable Justice Rehnquist.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. You go ahead and break out honorable if you want to. I haven't found anything honorable either about this opinion or the one a couple, 3 years ago, Michigan case, Bennis versus Michigan. Absolutely a disgrace.
What was that about?
That was where the woman sued for her interest in the car after it had been taken because her husband used it to go down and return the services of an attorney in downtown Detroit. And they impounded the car because they had a statute that said that if you could, use the vehicle in the commission of a crime, they could steal the vehicle. And it was Bennis versus Michigan. It buried the Fifth Amendment. If they could tie your property to a crime, they could just take anything they want. And
this is similar to forfeiture type laws, where they're in the
within minutes, virtually within minutes from the time that opinion came out of the Supreme Court, Oakland instituted a thing up there in Oakland, they were right. They were snagging tractor trailers.
Visit a hooker, lose your car, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a woman's interest. Oh, the words. The thing that made it such an abomination was that when push came to shove as to whether or not the woman had the interest in the car, because she was co-owner of the car, did not approve of the behavior, and you know, sued for her interest in the car. And on top of everything else, just to add insult to injury, Rehnquist pointed out that the car wasn't worth that much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, excuse me? You know, some jerk that we're overpaying to start with is going to determine what is affordable for somebody else that he couldn't relate to in a lifetime. I mean, it was just pathetic.
Well, getting back to the Atwater case, which initially, of course, came out with the headlines that, in essence, infractions were now going to be jailable offenses. You and I talked on the phone about this, and you reassured me and directed my attention back to the actual facts of this Texas case, which is, again, we're talking about the woman who was stopping the seatbelt ticket, and you pointed out that that in Texas, at least, up to the present moment.
It's a Texas law, and it is a misdemeanor level law
according
to their statutes. And it is written in there that unlike a speeding ticket, you know, and a speeding ticket where you endanger somebody else, you cannot be arrested, but for a seatbelt violation, they had it written that you could. Now, the legislature in Texas, within hours of this decision being announced, came in with a bill. They're in the process of getting it through now. I'd heard it was going to be done by Friday, but it'll almost surely be signed by the governor by next week. But they're getting rid of that law. They don't want to be they don't want to be involved in the glorious police state that they have brought to the rest of us. They want away from that statute themselves. But it's not going to change the fact that these words are on the pages of the Supreme Court. And what's happened is in the great police state of California, where it seems our legislature just waits for some little nod from the Supreme Court to violate the rights of the citizens or push the line toward those violations, that we can expect to see in very, very short order the same kind of heavy-handed legislation on infraction matters having to do with protecting ourselves, and I expect them to include all kinds of stuff.
Now, by infractions, let's clarify for the audience. An infraction is a crime, so-called crime, a minor crime that can only be punished by a fine, and you won't be allowed a public defender, nor will you be facing the threat of jail, but nor will you be allowed a jury trial. And these are things like, well, the sleeping ban, for instance, is an infraction at the municipal code level. Many vehicular code things are like a stop sign. Is that an infraction or a misdemeanor, do you know?
Most of your traffic is infraction stuff. And they do that why they do it at the state level I don't know, but in this county they take advantage of the fact that these things are listed as infractions to deny you due process in defending. And it's
by due process you mean like a jury trial or?
I mean like a fair and impartial hearing.
So
application of the law as it's written toward criminal actions.
Now let's get a little more specific here, because I know you have been working on this field for a decade, along with attorney Kate Wells, the issue of take me to a magistrate and the issue of a verified complaint. You want to kind of run that by us? I know we've talked about it before, but tell the person who might not understand what those two things are.
Wow.
If you're up to it.
Yeah, well, no, it's just pretty, I mean, that's a big demand, but
maybe would you like me to summarize it? Maybe then you can kind of tail.
Well, I'll do the best I can with the 40302. 40302C of the vehicle code is set up so that you have the opportunity when the officer stops you to be taken directly to someone in authority representing the courts to have the issue of the arrest challenged on the spot.
Take me to a magistrate.
Take me to a magistrate.
That's not take me to jail and book me, and in 2 days we get to go to court. That's different, right?
That's correct. It's supposed to be, you're supposed to take you directly to a magistrate or a magistrate's clerk where you'd be released on bail, but if you're going to do that, you might as well sign the ticket. The only reason to go to the magistrate is so that you can suggest to the court that perhaps this arrest is in excess of jurisdiction. It's called a probable cause hearing for the arrest. And since you can't be arrested in California for an infraction, unlike Texas, since you can't be arrested for an infraction in California, it's pretty difficult for the court in a probable cause hearing as to the arrest to explain what you're doing there.
Now, you know that the city attorney is arguing that there are such things as permitted as custodial arrests in infractions, such as the sleeping ban, if the conduct is likely to continue. What do you say to that?
Well, they will do whatever the courts locally will let them do, and the reason that they're breaking this stuff out and that they've ignored these other elements of the law for so long, and the police agencies, is because the courts haven't called them to it, the local courts. the local courts see the see a strict adherence to the plain language of the statute as detrimental to their goals, so they tend to ignore them. And it doesn't work out very well for anybody that happens to know what the law is, because you become immediately offended by the behavior, and of course there's nothing you can do about it because these local courts are so corrupt.
Yet there is something that you and Kate Wells have done about it, because I myself have visited the sheriff's office, and I see that on the form there now appears a box to check about, was the defendant or the suspect informed of her or his right to be taken to a magistrate?
Well, that's something that Kate did. I tried it, and they... because I'm not an attorney and I didn't have them in federal court, they just, you know, waved me off. Go away, boy, you bother me, kind of thing.
Well, I know you've been working on the issue, but what...
Well,
what?
I brought it to the attention of Kate years ago, and I definitely, you know, coached her in her understanding about how it's supposed to work. But she had a client that had found the same thing from the same source. We both studied under B.E. Smith, but he was several years behind me. He got arrested or invoked the take me to a magistrate, and they took him to jail. And when he got out of jail, he took him to federal court. And, of course, Kate was his lawyer. And the county tried to get out of that case saying that they didn't have to do that. And the district court says, oh, yes, you do. And so they settled the case, and part of the settlement is that the county now has to institute a procedure in law to accommodate a requirement that has existed in the vehicle code for over a quarter of a century.
Well, let me ask you this. Under what circumstances would it behoove a citizen or a person to use this take me to a magistrate provision? Give me an example of how that might be used.
The only example I can give you is the one that I'm looking forward to, and I'm waiting for them to institute this program so that I can move on it, and that's with a helmet ticket.
Tell me about that.
Well, there is no definition. There is no definition for a helmet, and so the courts have had to write some real stupid stuff to keep the helmet law in. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has stated that they have to have knowledge that the rider has absolute knowledge of the noncompliance of his helmet and actual knowledge of the noncompliance of his helmet, and in order for a citation to be issued. So if a cop pulls me over and decides to write that ticket, he's going to have to be able to explain to that magistrate what his actual knowledge is, that I know that the helmet is not compliant with some complex federal standard, and since I'm not aware of any such thing, it's going to be a little difficult for him to prove that I have actual knowledge. So I will be able to go in front of the magistrate, move for a probable cause hearing as to the arrest and the citation, and then the court has no choice, absent the evidence that the Ninth has laid out is required, except to dismiss it and send me back to my bike and let me go, and that's the end of it. Now, are they likely to do that? No, but that's, as I said before, the courts in this county do not follow the law. They will follow the law when it is visited in the federal court, and the federal court instructs them that they must. But I promise you, when they institute 40302C, it will not be in the highest spirit of compliance with the protections of the constitutional rights of the citizens of this county. They won't do that. They're not inclined, they're not motivated, they don't have no interest as far as I can tell.
Well, what about the rest of us? When should, say, I or somebody else who's not on a bike, on a motorcycle, when should we use this provision, and what should we be expecting?
Well, I'm thinking that any time that they're dealing with you over an infraction matter, and you can establish that you're not free to leave, then you're under arrest. And at that time, I would demand to be taken to the magistrate so that we can establish the nature of the charges and whether or not it's an arrestable offense going in. The worst that can happen is that the magistrate would have to do, unless you have a warrant or something, but just as on the basis of the stop, the worst that would happen is the judge would have you sign the equivalent of the ticket, you know, in his presence. You would be released on your own recognizance, which is what the cop does.
Now, does this apply to municipal code infractions like the sleeping ban?
Well, it should be, but it would have to come through the penal code. 40302C is a vehicle code thing.
And that's a different code than the penal code.
Well, but they break out the same tickets, and I'm not sure where the equivalent is in the penal code. But I do know that any time that you're taken into custody, you have a right you have a right to be taken immediately to a magistrate, and that doesn't mean, you know, 48 hours, 96 on a weekend.
Well, let's suppose I'm doing a For example, we're having a protest today at the town clock at 2 o'clock. This is actually happening, where we're going to be, you know, talking about the sleeping ban and escalating rents. And by the way, you're invited, Richard, in case you want to talk about this issue. I know you're real busy, you probably can't make it, but you would be welcome there to talk to the crowd of folks, and we're expecting a large crowd. But let's suppose after this rally, we all walked down to, City Hall, and then just laid down on the sidewalk or on in the grassy area and slept there. And the police came that night and said, okay, you're going to have to, we're giving you a ticket for sleeping after 11 o'clock at night in the city of Santa Cruz in a public place, which is a violation, an infraction under the municipal code 6.36.010A. And then I said to this police officer, well, I'm not going to sign this ticket because let me put it this way. I will sign this ticket before a magistrate if you feel this is an arrestable offense. Otherwise, am I saying I'm going to ignore the ticket? I mean, again, what do I have to sign and say, I know it's an infraction, but you haven't got the right to arrest me? What is my procedure at this point that would make it make your new take me to a magistrate provision, or I should say Kate's, a process that could be used in some significant way?
Well, today's not the day, because the courts haven't instituted the program yet. They still aren't doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, what they are doing is preparing a plan and instructions to the various police agencies, and I'm told that I will have a copy of that when it's completed. I will have a look at it and see how they've tried to fudge, and we'll be closer to being able to tell people what I would do in any given situation.
But
I would never tell them what to do, because that would be giving legal advice. But I will most certainly describe what it is that I would do under those circumstances.
But my question is, I mean, it's currently, whether they've gotten it together to get the process in place or not, that the law requires them to have that process today, in fact, yesterday, in fact, for the last quarter century, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, in fact, if they don't have the process and they screw up, they're legally liable, and you could conceivably sue them for civil penalties, right?
Well,
successfully sue them, conceivably.
Well, that depends on whether or not you get convicted and if you can do anything about the conviction. That's what I'm trying to tell you, that the system is so bogged down with corruption that it's virtually impossible to tell you how it will work, except that to advise you that it's very unlikely that it will work in compliance with the law.
I understand that, and we're given that, but I'm operating on the presumption that we're kind of proceeding in a purist fashion here. And I have this sleeping ticket, and
what I believe the court says is, or the law says. My belief, what the law says, and what they're required to do, is that when you're under arrest, that you demand to be taken to a magistrate. They either take you to a magistrate or they take you to a magistrate.
Now,
wait,
are you under arrest when they say, here you're violating the law in terms of you're sleeping in public, we're not going to arrest you, we just want you to sign this ticket? You are then at that point under arrest, right?
Well.
Is that my understanding?
The way that I solve that problem is to ask if I'm free to leave.
You mean without signing a ticket?
I just ask if I'm free to leave.
And they might.
I don't talk about the ticket. I ask if I'm free to leave. They come up and start talking to me. First order of business, turn on my recorder and get acquainted.
Mm-hmm.
Find out what they want.
Mm-hmm.
If they start bugging me with some rule or regulation that I think that they're pulling out of their back pocket that doesn't make any sense to anybody, then the next question out of my mouth will be, because now we have a legal issue involved, the next question will be, am I under arrest? And the reason for that question is to establish what my status is relative to that officer.
Well, let's do a little role-playing here. You're lying on the ground. It's 11:30 at night in a sleeping bag at this protest. I'm Officer Bailey or Sergeant Baker, and I come up to you and say, oh, Mr. Quigley, how are you tonight?
Yeah, I was trying to sleep before you come up and bothered me. What's up?
I'm afraid you can't really sleep here. It's a violation of Municipal Code 6.36010A.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're going to get up and move along. This is your warning. If you don't move along, I may have to cite you.
For what?
For violating 6.36.010A, that the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz.
Well,
there may be a place at the shelter. Maybe you can go to the shelter tonight.
Am I under arrest?
No, you're not under arrest.
Well, then I'm not obligated to talk to you. Why don't you just leave me alone?
Mr. Quigley, you're going to have to sign this ticket, or I'm afraid we'll have to take you into custody.
Sign a ticket or be taken into custody?
Yes, sir. This is a citation. You don't have to appear. It doesn't admit guilt.
Is that a threat, officer?
Well, I'm simply telling you the process we use here, Mr. Quigley.
It sounds to me like you're threatening me with arrest if I don't do something. If I'm under arrest, then I want to be taken to a magistrate, and if I'm not under arrest, I'd appreciate it if you just go away and leave me alone.
So are you telling me, Mr. Quigley, you're refusing to sign this citation?
Oh, absolutely not. I would never refuse any lawful order from a police officer, and if it was a lawful order for me to sign that ticket, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But if that's what you're ordering me to do, I suspect that's not a lawful order, and we need to get this in front of a magistrate, right? Is your supervisor around here? Can you get your supervisor out here?
He can be coming in a few minutes. But
why don't you get your supervisor out here? Because I got a feeling this is a little bit over your head.
Well, you know, Mr. Quigley, I'm quite aware of the
change. You don't understand. We're done. We're going to have a lawyer or your supervisor or both present to get this resolved. Any further conversation from you is inappropriate. You just take a break. We'll wait for your supervisor to get here, and then we'll resume this conversation.
And then another officer comes and says, is this guy giving you any trouble?
Absolutely not.
look, sir, you either...
By the way, if it starts to get tense, mm-hmm. then I throw both hands up in the air and commence to begin to holler, don't shoot.
I see. Well, Mr. Quigley, we're not trying to cause you any trouble. We just are telling you you have to either leave here, you can get up and leave, or you can sign this ticket for, you know, violating this code, which is a sleeping ban. You know about this code. You've been around this community for a long time.
Why are you talking to me? Are you searching for an admission or a confession or something? I mean, if you're trying to figure out some way to get me to admit to something by not saying something because you're talking, I think I got a feeling that I'd be better served if there were a lawyer present. If I'm not under arrest, you need to go away and leave me alone. If you're contemplating arrest, get your supervisor out here. And if you can't figure out what else to do, then we need to bundle up and head on over and see a magistrate so he can explain to you, leave me alone.
Mr. Quigley, it sounds to me like you are not going to be signing this ticket anytime soon. Is that true?
I don't know. I have no idea. And why do you keep asking me questions, the answer to which might tend to incriminate me?
Look, Mr. Quigley...
I've already told you, if we're going to talk about things that might incriminate me, we're going to get my lawyer involved.
Oh, please calm down and don't raise your voice,
Mr. Quigley. I'm not uncalm at all, but I don't understand why you're standing there talking like a lunatic.
There's no need to get excited, Mr. Quigley.
Right. Where's your supervisor?
My supervisor...
Have you called...